Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're taking a look at Kevin Costner's Horizon, an American Saga, Chapter 1. Boy, what a title. We watched all 3 hours and 2 minutes of it on HBO. We're excited to give you the rundown on what exactly is going on here and whether or not those next three parts are going to be worth your time. We're also going to take a look at Wim Wenders, for vendor heads out there. His Perfect Days 2023 feature is on Hulu, I think is where I watched it. It's good stuff, man. Won a couple awards at Cannes last year. That was the nominee for Japan's Best International Feature at the Oscars. It ended up losing to All Quiet on the Western Front. But we finally watched it. We didn't get to see it last year. I'm excited to talk about it. Before we get to all that, we need to talk about the new... Oh, wait, hold on. Before we get to those, we're going to talk about some trailers that are going to be coming up. We got three trailers for you in the middle of the show. Stick around for those, including that new Bong Joon-ho picture. Very excited to talk about the trailer for that. Cannot wait. Before we get to all of it, we need to talk about the news. Our first story this week, Michael B. Jordan is going to be back in the directing chair soon, hot off the set of Creed 3, a couple years ago now? But it may not be in a fighter, like many might be expecting. What is this new project he's working on with Amazon and MGM, Andy?
We are getting a reboot remake of The Thomas Crown Affair, which I actually remember the 1999 version with Rene Russo and Pierce Brosnan. The story is about a businessman who's like a thief, art thief on the side, and sets up this big, this big heist. Meanwhile, Rene Russo's character, the love interest, is the investigator, kind of hot on, she's chasing him, but she doesn't know she's chasing him. And they ended up having like this big romance while he's planning this heist. It was originally based on a 1968 series which starred Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway. And so we're getting yet another version, because that other version is 25 years old now, the 1999. So this is going to star Michael B. Jordan, I assume, in the lead role, and we don't have any other casting news. But this is a fun project. It's not the kind of thing that I would expect him to do.
Yeah, Hollywood Reporter covered this. It said the feature reteams Jordan with his Creed 3 studio after the film earned $276.1 million globally. That was also with Amazon MGM. So sticking with the studio, sticking with the team, just rolling it out again. And apparently Jordan has wanted to get into a Thomas Crown project for a while. He attached himself as an actor to this in 2016. So he's been sitting on this for 8 years. And if everything works out, this movie will be coming out in 2025. So that's a 9-year run wanting to play Thomas Crown. I have not seen the film. I have not seen the series, but I've definitely seen the cover. I vote with Pierce Brosnan on it. I'm familiar. Andy, any guesses on who might play who might play our femme fatale in this movie, right? Like Faye Dunaway in the old one, Rene Russo in the new one. It's gotta be some hot up and coming talent, right? It's gotta be somebody good.
Well, I think part of the takeaway is that, these aren't necessarily young people. They're just kind of established people. So it'll be someone in like their 30s, 40s in that. I mean, maybe like an Anne Hathaway, kind of that kind of role. The 99 version is kind of a modern classic. It's the heists are really fun. You got these kind of Ocean's 11 level stakeouts and heist thing going on, as well as this like torrid love affair between like the cat and mouse people involved. Like that's a great little movie. So I'm excited to see an update to that.
Yeah. Speaking of updates, James Cameron has a new project coming after Avatar, which is a ways down the road, but it might not be from where you expect. In fact, this would be the first time he's doing a non-Avatar project since like 1997 when he did Titanic. What is he doing, Andy?
Is next, it's based on a couple of books called Ghosts of Hiroshima, which is about a man who survived one nuclear blast in 1945 and then got on a train and went to Nagasaki or the other. I can't remember which city he starts in, but he goes from one city that gets bombed to the other city that gets bombed and survives both. And the book explores just the effects of that, the survivors of the nuclear blast, and juxtaposed with modern day kind of excavation of and looking back on it. We don't really have a lot of details yet, but this is going to be a huge thing. And James Cameron kind of has this obsession with like nuclear destruction. And it's a theme that's kind of constant in all his work, starting with Terminator and Terminator 2. So that's going to be his next project after Avatar, which I think is pretty bold and exciting.
Yeah, he had a great quote about this. Quote, "It's a subject that I've wanted to do a film about that I've been wrestling with how to do it over the years," Cameron told Deadline. "I met Satomi Yamaguchi, a survivor of both Hiroshima and Nagasaki, just days before he died. He was in the hospital. He was handing the baton of his personal story to us, so I have to do it. I can't turn away from it." And Andy's right. Like, Cameron does seem to have a relative theme in his work of kind of destruction and what comes after and humanity surviving through it. So I think there's certainly something there, not to mention some exciting buzz around Oppenheimer last year. Maybe some thoughts about how to tackle an atomic story has him officially interested. Now, when's he going to make this thing? I have no idea. That's not even clear. Deadline doesn't even have the deals. Everybody just says kind of when Avatar is like done. When Avatar's wrapped, I think we'll be moving on to the next thing. And I think he wants to make, what, 5 of these things, right? Like, and he's working on 3 right now. So I think it might be a ways down the line. It could maybe come out between Avatar films. I would think that's a possibility. But if we know anything about James Cameron, he's committed, and he also seemingly can't not make a hit. So whatever he makes, I'm sure he's going to make some money, despite the subject matter, right?
Yeah, I mean, he is. This is the kind of big spectacle thing he does. I mean, you're going to have huge sets, lots of people, lots of big effects, and you know he always knows how to tell a pretty impactful story, and so I'm definitely looking forward to this.
One more story from the box office this week. Beetlejuice is killing it at number one, which, you know, look, your boys here at Offscript get it right pretty often, but I'm going to be honest, I don't think any of us predicted that Beetlejuice was going to be the number one Stone Cold Stunner multiple weeks in a row, but hey, big things are going on in September. And by big things, I mean not a lot at the box office. So the things that are up there have got to be the big things. What else is going on over there?
Well, one of the things I said a couple of weeks ago is that Beetlejuice was not going to have any competition basically all month. There's no other really big releases. So it has all of September to excel itself. And it's come in now at $264 million globally, $76 million domestic. So it's doing really, really well. It was an $80 million budget. The general rule is like 2.5 times whatever that budget is to account for distribution and marketing. So it's already well into the profit territory. Now the big talk is, you know, is a threequel on the way? And like, no doubt that's going to happen as well.
We didn't end up covering Speak No Evil on the show this week, just because we'd both seen the trailers a dozen times and thought that
sick of it.
Let me tell you, that movie continues to do well on Rotten. It has a B+ cinema score from audiences. It's making some decent money. Like, I think we'll probably slide that onto the streamer watch list at some point. Like, we'll end up watching it later this year, just because I don't really feel like particularly interested in the theatrical experience for that. But I hear James McAvoy's great in it. And then meanwhile, there's this documentary, big surprise for the weekend, from Matt Walsh and The Daily Wire. It's called Am I Racist, which is doing well for a documentary, which I guess is cool, but I have no interest in watching a white man get in a disguise and find out whether or not he's a racist. Like, that sounds like something that should have gone straight to a streamer. That probably should have gone straight to whatever Daily Wire's streaming service is. I don't know. What do I know?
It has been successful. That's what the main reason we're talking about is that it was, I think, the most successful documentary in like half a decade, for whatever reason. And it is, you know, people are going out and seeing it, despite it's kind of very provocative content. It's been described as kind of a Borat style guerrilla documentary, something like that. We're not going to be covering it on the show. And apparently no critics. There's no critic score for this because they also refuse to watch it.
Also not going to be covering Reagan, the Ronald Reagan biopic from Dennis Quaid. We did talk about the trailer. I know it's out. I'm not particularly interested in it. And then also The Killer's Game, starring Dave Bautista, Big Dave, who we love, getting killed at the box office. It's R-rated. No. It came in 6th place. Nobody cares.
Bautista bombed the box office.
Man, I feel bad. My man's working hard. I feel bad we're not getting out there supporting him. But like, I don't know.
Like, that looked like a podcast.
We're not interested.
That looked like
in
a straight-to-streaming movie.
It really did. Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. Hey, I am excited to see Dennis Quaid of Reagan fame in Substance next week. That's going to be sick with Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley.
I also wanted to mention that Deadpool and Wolverine still number 3 at the box office, and it's like 8th week. That film's made $1.3 billion. Huge, huge success for Marvel. And Disney continues to be in the box office. I think it's actually going to streaming like in next month in October, and it's still in theaters now.
Oh, all right, dude. Deadpool Wolverine continuing to crush. I still help to tell people that have seen it. They're like, what's a great movie you've seen this summer? I'm like, Deadpool Wolverine's fun. They're like, yeah? Really? Good time? Like, yes, it's solid. It's the reason it's doing so well. Like, rock solid movie. You won't be disappointed. But when we talk about films that are good, we need to talk about, of course, Horizon, An American Saga, Chapter 1, which I'm excited to cover, frankly, on this show. Andy and I have joked and jeered and jabbed at Kevin Costner's new directorial debut for a long time. So now it seems perfectly fitting that we step back, all right, and sit in our seats and eat our popcorn and discuss what is happening in this movie. Andy's going to be taking the summary on it. Thank God. So please excuse. I'm not delivering it. Andy is. Andy's going to be taking the summary on this one. I'm going to get out of his way. Andy, please take it away.
Horizon, An American Saga, Chapter 1. So to catch you up on this entire film saga, this is a vision by Kevin Costner, who left his very successful show called Yellowstone kind of abruptly and under weird circumstances, and he was pursuing this passion project, which he's envisioned as four movies, 3 hours in length each one, so 12 hours of film. The first one, Horizon Part 1, came out in June, was a huge bomb. No one went to see it. It premiered at Cannes to mixed reviews, which I think were being polite. Part 2 premiered at the Venice Film Festival, also to mixed reviews. This thing's hasn't been well received, but it is streaming on Max, and we thought we'd take a look at it. Kevin Costner has put up a lot of his own money to try and create this big Western epic. So let's get into it. There is a lot going on. There's a lot of storylines. The three main ones are everything's surrounded by this settlement of Horizon, where people are going. They're trying to settle the Old West, build towns, villages, but they're doing it in the middle of Apache Indian territory, and they get raided a lot. The first initial settlers are instantly killed, like in the opening scene. Then the town is rebuilt with more people, and it gets raided again. So this is kind of a theme that happens. We have our military people that come out there and be like, why are you guys trying to settle this land? Like, you can't. Like, you just shouldn't. But they're the indomitable American spirit is gonna do it. There's a couple of other storylines. We finally get Kevin Costner's character as Hayes Ellison, who's a lone wolf and a horse trader who gets mixed up with a brothel girl named Marigold, who's got some bad actors chasing her. She's also in charge of a child. Jenna Malone's involved in it as well. I'm just trying to give real broad strokes because there's so much going on. Our third main storyline is Luke Wilson, who's part of a wagon train moving west through Wyoming. All these storylines, I think, will eventually converge in the town of Horizon. We don't get there. We also have some perspectives of the Native Americans as well. It's filled with lots of tropes you recognize in movies and Western. You have love interests. You got gunfights. You got shootouts. You have wagons, horses, everything. You small towns, brothels, the works. So tons going on. Those are the broad strokes. Zach, let's get into it. What'd you think?
So there's this great line, this quote, the scene at the end of Steven Spielberg's The Fablemans that I've been thinking about a lot since watching Horizon that I'm excited to tell you. It's when David Lynch is playing John Ford at the end of the movie. And he's telling young Sammy Fableman how to make a movie. And he gives this really simple line. He points to a couple paintings of Westerns in his office. And he says, look at this one over here. When the horizon's at the bottom, it's interesting. And then he points to another and says, when the horizon's at the top of the frame, it's interesting. And he says, when the horizon's in the middle, it's boring as shit. Like, now that's my advice. Get out of my office. Like, that's what he says. In, like, Horizon's biggest cardinal sin is that the horizon's in the middle and it's boring. It's shot like TV and it's structured like TV. And they did takes like TV, and like it's so dull in the middle, and it's like, oh God, this is 3 hours. I made it like 6 or 7 minutes into the movie before I realized, like, oh no, it's going to be this the whole time. It's going to be one or two takes of a few actors with the camera pulled back in a medium shot, and then maybe a cut to a close up on occasion, and then next scene, because we got to film 3 hours of this stuff, and it's like, oh God, oh no, they went too far. And I think it's an issue scale. I think Costner is trying to shoot what's supposed to be 12 hours of content, right, on a budget that's pretty large, by the way. And I'm a little surprised they couldn't get more visually interesting for how much money they're spending. And it's just too much. He hasn't directed in a while. It's too much. And the whole movie suffers, man. Like, I think it's too many storylines. I think it's too it's just too chunky. So let's get into it, because it's not all bad. There is stuff that works. And I do actually think I will probably end up watching part two. And I want to talk about why. If I can swing in here and talk about how awful it is, why would I still be interested in coming back for more? I want to talk about it. What did you think of Horizon?
Similarly in that you are definitely just, you're watching TV. Like, this is structured like TV. It feels a little cheap like TV, and not like HBO prestige shows. It feels like a CBS, like a Star Trek kind of, like, it's like, it's not bad, but it's like, it's very like dad core TV. There are way too many characters. I don't know anyone's name. I know Kevin Costner's name. That's it. Hayes Ellison. Who doesn't show up until the second hour of the movie. And Luke Wilson doesn't show up until the third hour of the movie. So it just shows you how much is in here. There's so many characters and there's so many plot lines that they don't really cross yet. It looks like they eventually will in the future, but they don't. I was confused a lot of times because it just jumps around a lot and you don't stay a lot of time with the characters to really remember them. And it would come back to something and I'd be like, oh, this character is dead. I didn't realize he was dead. It wasn't obvious that this character had died anywhere at the thing. I think the spectacle of it, the vision is grand. And like, there's a big, I think it's like a 10 to 15 minute long scene of the Indian attack on Horizon. All the settlers like hold up inside of the town or inside a big building. And there's, you know, they're exchanging gunfire and they're setting stuff on fire. It's a big action sequence about a half hour in. It still feels like TV action, though. It's just, it's not super, super convincing. Yeah, he's got too much dip on his chip.
He's got too much dip. Yeah, right. It's all foam and no beer. You're right. Like, there are moments, there are set pieces in Horizon that are exciting and good. You're right. Like the Indian raid on the town in like the first half hour, 45, like the first act, fundamentally solid. There's a duel and a chase in this movie. Solid. Like there's like a military encampment and then like a bunch of soldiers out there that are all working together. And there's this great speech from Danny Houston. Solid. Like that stuff works good. The 2.5 hours around those segments, chunky and real slow. Rough. And dude, it is real hard not to get your phone out. And it feels like, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to watch it on streaming is so we could watch it in parts explicitly, because we figured, hey, it's probably going to be slow. It's Costner's first directing film out in a while, or first time in the director's chair in a while. Like, maybe it'd be something we could kind of piece out better. And I do think it's better served over there. While I do think, like, it's probably most visually distinct moments are in its landscapes, the landscapes just aren't shot that good. The director of photography, I went and looked, cinematographer J. Michael Murrow, has worked with Costner in the past on a bunch of features. He shot Dances with Wolves. He shot Field of Dreams. Costner directed Dances with Wolves. Like, they specifically worked together. Since then, J. Michael Murrow has gone on to do a lot of TV. He primarily comes from work as a Steadicam op. My man's bread and butter is like a medium shot with a couple actors waist up, like chatting with the horizon in the middle, because he shoots TV and you shoot it and then you go to the next scene. You do a couple takes and you move on. And like, it just makes for a long 3 hours, man. Like, I kept thinking of, like, I know this is going to be a far cry. I kept thinking of Lord of the Rings. Can't help it. You think of a 3 hour feature that you really enjoy. Lord of the Rings comes to mind. Like, Jackson and his second unit director, whether that be his wife Fran or Andy Serkis, whoever he's working with, like they go to so much great lengths to make things so visually distinct all the time. You can just think in your head, like you could see memes or flashes of shots of Lord of the Rings and immediately think of where they come from, what they are. Like, Horizon does not have that at all. I could show you just stills from Horizon and you probably couldn't even tell me like when it comes from in the film, or certainly anybody's name.
What storyline is this from?
Yeah. Like, it's, and I think it's just too much, man. Like, I think he should have pared it down. I think he should have cut two or three of these plots out, focus a little bit more on the ones that work. I think you'd have something that's a lot more reasonable than this. Like, this is this, it's just too, it's too thick around the middle. It's got a big waistband.
Yeah, there's so much going on, and it's so surface level. Like, a good Western, like a good horror movie, it's general, should be about other things. Like, I just watched the original 1976 Carrie for the first time, and it's one of these classic horror movies I'd never seen. And a lot of times, you know, a classic horror movie may be classic for, but may not be age well. And I loved it. And part of what I loved is like, oh, this movie is about something. It's about that movie. Carrie is about like religious oppression and bullying and like all these themes. And like Horizon has, it's not about anything outside of the indomitable American spirit in one scene, but that you have all these characters like with that are just tropes and archetypes. You have Sienna Miller, who's kind of the love interest of the Union soldier. Oh, that's, by the way, the Civil War is going on in the background.
The lieutenant. Yes, right. Yeah.
But there's things like she has a daughter who has a crush on a guy going to fight in the Civil War, and it comes out of nowhere. she's just all of a sudden crying over this guy leaving. You know, he's the lone gunman. There's the girl from the brothel. There's the bad guys chasing the, I mean, it's just like, there's the wagon train, and it's just like kind of eye rolling the archetypal, and it just doesn't have anything to say. There's so many characters. And you don't know anyone's name. They don't stay with characters long enough for us to get to know them. And Costner does this cardinal sin. He does this thing that Clint Eastwood likes to do, where he writes himself as the most attractive man that ever lived. And he's this gruff lone gunman, and the brothel girl's like fawning over him, and he's like, no, stay away from me, no, I don't need you. And then of course he ends up getting involved with her anyways, and you know, reluctantly he's like, well, I guess we're in this together now, that kind of thing. And he does the voice just like that. He's a super low gruff thing. It's hilarious, but it's just like, come on, man.
Yeah, he really, dude, Costner really writes himself a treat in this movie, like, for sure. He gets all the sweet lines, he gets all White the cool Knight. Scenes, he gets the hottie who is just fawning over him and cannot let him go. Like, meanwhile, I think there's some other performances that are solid. Andy had mentioned just yesterday when we were talking about Horizon, Danny Houston's got a really great speech in the middle of this. Sam Worthington's fun. It's a guy who one of the bad guys in this movie. He's a kid from Sweeney Todd. He's one of the British kid. He's also in Harry Potter. I can't recall his name off the top of my head. Solid. Yeah, that's him. Yeah, Jake Campbell as kind of this evil mustache twirling individual that ends up running into Costner. Every time the movie cuts away from like characters we know to new characters you haven't seen before, I felt like my heart was leaving my chest. Like, oh no, like they're introducing more characters and more plot when you barely get enough time with the ones we have. It's just too full. I'm reminded also of like Cloud Atlas, the Wachowski siblings film. Also, directed by Tom Tykwer, who would go on to do Les Miserables and Cats. That had three directors, and that had six storylines. And each director took two explicitly. The end of the film credits them. Tom Tykwer did these. This Wachowski did these. This Wachowski did these. That's how we did it. And then they explicitly, because it's based on a book, had like editing points where it's all woven together and it cuts from one to the other. And it works pretty good while still being a confusing movie that's difficult for people to pick up. This movie, meanwhile, like, does not have the luxury of three well-seasoned directors. It's one director and a director of photography with a deep bench, admittedly, but a lot of television background. Like, just try to put it all together, and I just think it's too much. And I think for Horizon 2 and 3 and 4, dude, they gotta tighten the bolts. They gotta tighten the bolts. Or, like, Horizon 2, skip three of these storylines. Save them for 3. Just leave them out. Just focus on, like, two or three of these. Really, really focus on them. I think it can get somewhere. And I do feel like, because of the time investment, that I want to watch 2. Like, I would be interested to see what happens. But, like, if two doesn't get me any further down the road than this one, I don't think I'm coming back for 3 and 4. Like, boy.
I have heard that 2 is slightly better. So there's that. I think this would have been a hit TV show. I think this would have made great TV. but he wanted to do this film thing. Part the other thing I wanted to talk about is that this is definitely like American Old West propaganda, like Manifest Destiny, all that.
Yeah.
It does attempt to be balanced and show some perspective from the Native Americans, but it's like a fraction of everyone else. And again, we have like, oh, the poor, helpless settlers, did they just want to, you know, settle this land and build their homes? And they kind of, you know, they definitely are glossing over the slaughter of indigenous people. They do kind of address it near the end, but it's I was reminded of a much better movie, Hostages, with Christian Bale, that covers like that topic, and that's a really brutal film, but it's excellent. I mean, that's right. When I was watching this, I was just reminded of a million other Westerns that are so much better. It's like Unforgiven, Power of the Dog, Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Buster Scruggs, dude. Yeah, big time. Yeah, because that's like a Western that's got so many storylines in it. Yeah, absolutely. I thought of like 310 to Yuma, even, like, which is more action oriented. Like, I'm really frustrated with what's here, and I don't think it's beyond saving. I don't. They already have shot Horizon Chapter 2. This movie actually has a bit of a preview for what's to come in Chapter 2, which is hilariously long, far too long for what it is. And yeah, I do think there's some stuff in there that looks good, especially now that you've got some characters roughly or really like character silhouettes established even. Yeah, like, I don't know any of these people's names. I tried. Andy had watched it before me and was like, try to remember some of the names. I was like, all right, yeah, sure. And sure enough, by the end of it, next day, like, they're all gone. I can't remember 24 different people. Like, I don't, you know, you remember the archetypes, you remember the broad strokes, and for that stuff, it's good. I do think it's going somewhere, but I just don't know if it's going to get there. And also, yeah, one more mention, two more mentions. A, the soundtrack is fine and works best, I think, in the first third. The rest of it felt relatively forgettable. And B, it is like almost unnecessarily cruel towards indigenous people, in my opinion. There's a shot when there's during this like raid on this fine settlers camp of colonizers in the open, when there's like a small family in a tent. And they're getting raided by Injuns, so they know it's almost over. And they have like a small barrel of gunpowder sitting between them, and the dad's got a candle, like they're gonna blow themselves up, right?
Yeah,
and like an Injun whips open the tent with a spear, and the mom's like, "Close your eyes." Like, as a kid, close his eyes, and he blows them all to hell. I'm like, oh my god! Like, you'd rather blow up you and your damn family. Like, oh my god! Yeah, and then there's like one scene of like a bunch of Native Americans like sitting in a camp talking about how awful it was. Like, just they got to turn the ship in two. This is not the direction forward. The ship is moving, but we got to turn it into straighter waters, I think, because this is. I don't think you get four of these. I really don't. I don't even know if you get to the end of three of them.
Yeah, I'm kind of like you though. I do kind of want to see where the next entry goes when it comes to streaming. I'll watch it. That said, the funny thing is that it doesn't really end. There's this like 5-minute montage at the end of things to come, which I was angry about because there's shots in the trailer for this movie that are not in this first movie at all. And then I saw those shots again in like the next, like,
in the
trailer.
Montage.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, so it's maybe again, but also the montage is like 5 minutes long. Like, you think it's going to be like a 2-minute trailer of things to come, and it just keeps going, like, just never stops. And it's like, yeah, like I wasn't aware that it had started, because like, there's not a solid ending to this part.
Right. Like, you just segue out of a shot of the desert to another shot of the desert, then it cuts to another and another, and before you know it, you're in a montage and you're like, oh boy, like I'm into next time on Horizon. What's the course from here, Andy? Like, what do you, second one goes to theaters, I guess. You think the third and fourth one will make it, or are those going to be streaming joints? I mean,
three and four haven't been made yet, so those are really dependent on the success of one and two. I can see, if the second one comes out and it will probably bomb, I can see three and four maybe getting picked up by a streaming service.
I bet Cosner saves some face in a few years when they do like a Horizon director's cut or like Horizon redo or something, and they parse it out, re-edit it, tighten up some of this stuff, maybe give you a little bit more for each story in chunks instead of just kind of splitting and flitting from spot to spot. And more importantly, I know I've said it a dozen times on this show, but I'll say it again. They need to give it like the Hateful Eight treatment on Netflix. Make it a limited series, split it up into chunks, give it title credits and episodes, like make it 12 episodes somewhere. Think of the thumbnails, right? You could have Luke Wilson on one and Giovanni Ribisi on another and Sam Worthington on another. Like, boy, what a multifaceted cast for all the people here and for all the locations they're shooting on. Like, it just seems like a layup. It seems like on paper, this would be so much better than it is. And then you watch it and you realize, oh my God, it's boring. It's the worst thing you could do. You could be boring, you know? It's, like, that's, yeah, it doesn't really have anything to say.
I struggled. I watched the first hour works as like an episode. Feels like an hour of TV. The second section is about 45 minutes. And then Luke Wilson gets in. And then that last hour and 15 minutes is all over the place because it's jumping between like five storylines. I really struggled with the last hour.
Yes, it is critically unfocused. And it's like, it just seems obvious. Like it was too much to handle. He's not really sure where it's going. Like I don't have a lot of confidence in the direction. But in fear of us being boring, I should say, we should move on to our official final reviews on this. Andy, would you recommend Horizon, An American Saga, Chapter 1?
I think if you're a fan of Westerns and you're a fan of Kevin Costner and kind of want to see what he's trying to do, I would say give it a chance. It's available on streaming. Definitely watch it in chunks. You can break it down into like three or four digestible chunks. I think the vision is exciting. It's just the execution that isn't great. Outside of that, I would say hard pass.
Yeah, it's streaming only, I think, is where you're going to want to watch it. I would say for the next one that comes out, unless you're some kind of insane Western fan that saw the first one in theaters and can't wait to go ride for the next one, dude, just wait till it comes to streaming. Like, it's not, I don't know. Like, I wasn't particularly impressed by, like, lens choice. You're not getting, like, ultra-wides of this, like, incredible American landscape. Like, It just feels like the locations are like an excuse for quick, fast production because we got to shoot 12 hours of this series and we got to get going right now and we're on a budget and we got to make it happen. And it's like, oh boy. Yeah, watch it on streaming if you can. Watch it in chunks, I guess. If you're a Western fan, maybe you'll be into it. If not, like, pass. You can enjoy the results of reading about Horizon Chapter 2 and Chapter 3 and Chapter 4 as they come out with the rest of us. And of course, keep your eye on Off Script because we might end up watching that episode too. Might end up getting around to watching Chapter 2. We'll see. With that, we should move on to our next segment. Excited to talk about these. Some upcoming trailers. Some things coming along soon. Andy, what do we call this segment?
It's time for the Trailer Park. We're going to be bringing you three trailers today. The first of which, we are into spooky season. October is here. I love that Halloween is just turning into a two-month holiday. It's like September, October is now all Halloween season. Part of that is this new trailer for Salem's Lot, the Stephen King adaptation. This movie was actually made as a movie in 1979. That is 3 hours long. I could not believe how long the original Salem's Lot is. This new version is only 2 hours and it will be on Max. It's straight to streaming joint. And it deals with this town in Maine, of course, that is kind of flooded by or infested with vampires that come out at night. We don't get a lot of kind of plot in the story other than it's the story of an author coming back to his hometown to deal with like this threat. But it looks kind of spooky, kind of scary.
Yeah, I'm surprised it's a film because like at the top it almost looked like a miniseries, but I also had no idea the OG was 3 hours in length, and that really explains why of all the like 80s and 90s King adaptations I've seen or been told to check out, nobody has recommended Salem's Lot. Now I get it. But on its face, looks interesting, and hey, you got that young Lewis Pullman pulling what looks like the protagonist role, and he's great, man. We loved him in Bad Times at the El Royale is his premiere as far as I could tell. Now he's doing this. Anything can happen. Probably low budget, a little smaller, straight to streaming. But also reminds me of like a Mike Flanagan project, right? Like he's been doing over on Netflix. And I think it might get theatrical for like a week, right? It's a chance.
Maybe. I think it is intended as a straight to streaming kind of thing. But it's definitely the kind of thing I'll sit down and watch. I've actually talked with some other king heads in my life that want to get together and have a little a watch party, which I think will be a lot of fun. Another one that we just saw this week is a film called Brothers. This actually is also another straight to streaming joint going to Amazon Prime on October 17th. This is A Family of Criminals, which stars Peter Dinklage, Brendan Fraser, and Josh Brolin, who are estranged family members come together for one last heist, one last job involving emeralds of some sort. Glenn Close is also in this movie. She's the mother of she's the matriarch of this family, and she's got a plan to heist these diamonds, and they're all, it's a very dysfunctional thing. Marissa Tomei is also in it, and they're going to be working together. It's an action comedy thing. This looks like a lot of fun, perfect straight to streaming kind of movie.
Yeah, obviously you're reminded of something like Twins, starring like DeVito and Schwarzenegger, right? Like two brothers who could not look more different, but like obviously have to get along. Looks like a fun time. Looks all right. I don't know. I'm excited to see Pete Dinklage back at it again. As for Josh Brolin, boy, I do not believe Josh Brolin in a t-shirt ever. He's wearing this like pink t-shirt in half this trailer. Yeah, I'm like, I do not. You just look like Josh Brolin. Whoever you're trying to play, I'm not convinced. Maybe when I watch the movie, it'll come through. But like, my man has got too storied of a career at this point. He can't get away from being a Brolin head. One more trailer to talk about. Very excited about this one. Bong Joon-ho's new film, Mickey 17, has a trailer. This is based on a couple of books Andy told me before the show. I wanted to make sure I get that right. About a young man in the near future who signs up to be an expendable, to go on missions where he will die and be resurrected so the humanity can move forward with scientific experiments and all kinds of stuff. Mickey is played by Robert Pattinson, and he's doing a weird voice.
I
can't wait. Yeah, that's right. Movie also stars Steven Yeun, Mark Ruffalo, Toni Collette. Weird stuff, ma'am. Weird sci-fi stuff. And Warner Brothers knows it's weird, because coming hot off the heels of Parasite, Warner Brothers was very excited to get in on Bong Joon-ho's next project. He made this. This was supposed to come out March this year, and Warner Brothers held it and said, nope. It's too weird. We're running it by test audiences. People kind of hate it. We're going to wait, and we're going to put it out in January, where movies go to die. And worth mentioning, by the way, January 2025, looking kind of good. Between this, you got that new Paddington movie. Like, you might be surprised. You might be some bangers in January.
January might hit.
But I do think general audiences are probably going to hate Mickey 17. I think it looks awesome. What do you think, Andy?
This looks like a lot of fun. It reminds me a little bit of Moon, the 2009 film with Sam Rockwell, that has a similar storyline about like clones working on the moon in that one. I think what surprised me about this trailer is that just the tone of it is very funny. Like this is almost shot like a comedy, but it's very much probably has a lot of like social commentary. It's like the first act of Parasite is pure comedy. Like it's so funny. And that's kind of what this movie looks like as well. Like it's going to be very like almost tongue in cheek about this ridiculous situation, and then it will probably have a more serious turn about halfway through.
Yeah, I would imagine that's probably where it's going. I'm stoked about the cast. It looks really weird, and again, Rob Pattinson doing like a weird voice is fantastic, and I can't wait to check it out. So that's Mickey 17. We will cover that and likely these other movies on this very show. So if you want to keep up with us or what we're doing, you know, just hit that subscribe button. I'll tell you again at the end of the show. For now, we should get back to the reviews. One more to go in this episode. And I'm going to be taking the summary on this one, so please excuse any clumsy delivery. The movie is Perfect Days. So, Wim Wenders' new picture, Perfect Days, is about I completely forgot his name.
Hirayama.
I almost had it. We were talking about Cameron's new picture, and I was going to say Hiroshima, and that is not it. It's Hirayama. Wim Wenders' new project, Perfect Days, is about Hirayama, who is a toilet cleaner in Japan, Tokyo specifically, and he lives his life simply. All right, he's a man of routine. He wakes up early in the morning, he folds up his bed, he waters his plants, he goes outside, he takes a big breath of fresh air, he gets a drink from the same vending machine, a Boss coffee every morning. He hops in his car, he drives to work, cleaning toilets around Tokyo, public toilets that are very, very nice, by the way. A bit of history to those outside of the movie that I'm excited to tell you here in just a moment. That's pretty much it. He eats lunch in the same park. He takes a photo of the trees. He sees people, the same people throughout every day. He sees his coworker who's lazy and uninspired. He'll see a woman sitting on the bench across from him, kind of looking forlornly, similar to him. And on occasion, different people might wander into his life. His sister from long ago, a niece. He may find out that his cassette tape collection, which he loves and is very old, is now worth a lot because cassettes are worth something. But that's it. Fundamentally, Perfect Days is just a series of days in the life of this man. And what's so interesting about Perfect Days is I think it is uniquely slow cinema. I've heard it compared to Jim Jarmusch's Patterson, which I haven't seen, but I would assume is probably also slow in this pace. So if you've seen Patterson, there you go. Perfect Days is uniquely about a man whose life is not really that good. It's actually kind of bad. But he doesn't see it that way. And he's aware of how things are in his life, but he chooses to live simply and he chooses to ignore the things that frustrate him. And he chooses to be happy and look on the bright side and see the right side of things. And in that way, I think the spirit of Perfect Days is really redeemable. Like it's really heartfelt. And it's a really, really quantitatively strong message for the people that are there to see it. But it's also 2 hours long, and I know a lot of people who would watch this movie and say, oh my God, it's so boring. it's a bit of a struggle, and I think that's where we should start talking about it. Andy, what did you think of Perfect Days?
It's definitely slow, but I was with it pretty much the whole time. It was, in my opinion, the exact opposite of Horizon, where we have this character. Perfect Days is so good about being show, don't tell. Because Hirayama doesn't really talk at all. He's very, very quiet, very shy, very soft-spoken. So everything is told through action and through like his reaction, his facial expressions. He has this meticulous routine. He gets up at like 5. He waters his plant. He gets ready to go. He always gets a soda in the morning. He plays these like American old rock band cassettes tape. And then he goes to his job where he's very proud of this work, like meticulously scrubs these public toilets. And like in Japan, these public restrooms are incredible. They're like spaceships. They have bidets. They're completely hands-free. It's a completely different society. But also, I mean, he's got this mirror that he looks under the toilet and under the rim to make sure it's spotless. Like cleans everything, has a very meticulous routine, goes home, goes to this public place to shower. In the evening, he goes to a bar, to like a sports bar, and gets a drink and noodles. And then he just repeats. And it's kind of this, he lives this very quiet life, which he really enjoys. It's very simple. And you can tell that he has made this choice very consciously to live this way, which is kind of baffling to some other people in his life. But he also kind of longs for connection, human connection, family, though he kind of looks longingly at different couples or the singular woman that he sees. He has an apprentice or an employee that's kind of a bit of a buffoon, but he's kind of glad to be around. So he definitely is lacking a little bit of human connection at the same time. So the portrayal of the character, I think, is so good and such a great juxtaposition to something like Horizon.
Yeah, Koji Yakusho played the lead Hirayama, storied actor over in Japan, and he actually won Best Actor at Cannes when this came out. This movie also won a really odd award that I've never paid attention to, the prize of the economical jury at Cannes, like Cannes, I always say Cannes, it's Cannes, also won that, so like did great and got nominated for Best International Feature at the 96 Academy Awards, lost to All Quiet on the Western Front, show movie we also covered on this show, very good. But Perfect Days is like uniquely small, and it's uniquely intimate, and as you kind of see Hirayama's first day in kind of our first act, and we walk through it bit by bit, like you just questions start to come up in your mind, right? Like, okay, first off, who is this man? Why is he so driven? Does he have anybody else in his life? Is he alone all the time? How did he get to be this way? Why is he so soft-spoken? Often he doesn't speak at all. Like, where does the analog record collection come from, you know, or a cassette collection? Why are they all American needle drops? Which, by the way, are great. Great, by the way. Spotify playlist for Perfect Days is a banger. Would recommend, like, solid needle drops all the way through when Winders does not disappoint in any of his features, including this one. And I think there's a great term that comes up actually at the end of the film after the credits. And I don't normally spoil stuff on the podcast, but I want to point it out here because I think it's a good thing to talk about. It's called komorebi. Komorebi, a Japanese word for the play of sunlight through leaves. It can also be used to describe the shimmering of light and shadows created by leaves swaying in the wind. There's no easy English translation for it, but some say it's a feeling rather than a word. It's a reminder to find the small beams of light that exist in the dark, rather than just focusing on the light at the end. Like, to see the journey as you're doing it, rather than focusing on like what comes later. And that seems to be Hirayama's like fundamental like thing, his reason for being. It's the thing that he chases. In fact, when he's on lunch, he'll take photos of the trees above him and go through them and pick his favorites and keep them and catalog them meticulously. One of his few hobbies in the film. And I think, like, through most of the movie, it feels like Hirayama is like a unicorn. He's almost godlike, right? Like, he's this man who has seemingly like an unlimited source of energy, who always sees the bright side, who is uniquely happy and longs for nothing. Like, he has everything he needs, right? He's got his cassette collection. He's got his little apartment. He's got his plants. He's got the park. He's got the sunlight, which is why it's like uniquely heartbreaking when you spend any more time looking at it and realize that his life is not good. It's not good. Like, he lives alone. He's older. He doesn't really have anybody. His apartment sucks. It's not getting nicer. He's broke. He can't afford anything. He cleans public toilets for a living. Like, it's bad. And people, like, take pity on him. Like, people look down on him. And he knows it. And that's exhausting. And it's been really cool hopping online and looking up how people's kind of first reactions were to watching Perfect Days and seeing people say, how is this a happy feature? What's good about this? Like, his life sucks. And, like, I think what's so uniquely special about Perfect Days is that it is a happy feature because it's about choosing simplicity, like choosing not necessarily negligence, but ignorance, like choosing to see the brighter spots of things in your life that really matter, that really count, the experience you're having while you're having it, right? Now is now and next time is next time. Like, that's what this movie is about. That's what it does so well. I also want to talk about the toilets, but I want to give Andy a chance to talk because I found some cool trivia about these I'm excited to share.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the city itself. So this is in Tokyo, and the city is a character all of its own. And, you know, this is one of these things. It's not giving you, like, the Hollywood version. It's the parks. It's the public toilets. It's the small roads. He's got this adorable tiny van. And I was like, I wish I had a car like that. It's so small.
Yeah.
And there's this great... It pans up to this like big tower that's in Tokyo. I don't know what it's called, but we focus on that image quite a bit, and I'm not quite sure what it means. And I love a movie that has that kind of symbolism that leaves me kind of asking, like, oh, what does that mean? But the city itself is such a vibrant place, and I think part of this, the reason this movie is I think a happy feature, is he is finding pleasure in the small things, but also learning to reappreciate human connection, because it seems like in the beginning he's very happy to be alone and not be bothered and have his routine. And then his, like, when his niece comes and stays with him, like, she kind of disrupts his routine a little bit, and he's simultaneously bothered or annoyed by that, but also glad to have some company. And that's part of what the movie is about kind of re-establishing that need for human connection and that appreciation for those kinds of relationships.
Right. Hirayama's perfect day is the one where nobody bothers him. Like, so really the ones that aren't perfect are the ones where problems come up, right? His coworker shows up late to work again, or his niece who hasn't seen in years, like, shows up to stay with him for a couple days. But he comes to find that, like, really even the ones that don't go perfect are special and unique. And that's kind of the larger lesson. The toilets. I got to talk about these. So I was wondering why all the toilets in this movie are so nice. All the, like, public bathrooms. Because they're all in Tokyo, and they all look like art installations. They're so nice and unique and feature, like, elements of nature, which is perfect for Hirayama because that's a big part of his lifestyle. So I got the answer. I got the rundown, all right? Japan had 20 public toilets built for the 2020 Olympics when they were hosting, and they wanted to figure out a way to like kind of highlight or really tell people or show people that these like really nice public toilets had been built and were available and anybody can use them. So they had had an idea for some kind of like art investment to maybe make a documentary about them or something, like just to kind of tell the world, hey, we made these things that are really nice and are still here after the Olympics. Anybody can use them. They're now part of our infrastructure. And somehow Wim Wenders got into the mix for being a part of this. And then rather than make a documentary, he kind of, I don't know, he looked at him and was like, I think I should just make a feature. So they shot Perfect Days in like 17 days. It's a really quick shoot, less than a month. Start to finish, you know, got through the whole thing, got everything they needed and moved along. But boy, like, man, if there was ever a public bathroom I wanted to use, it's in freaking Tokyo, dude. Like, these toilets he cleans are so nice. And the infrastructure he supports is so unique because he has to go to a public shower. Like, he doesn't have a shower in his apartment. He can't afford one, right? Like, and he drives a crappy company van and he wears company clothes everywhere. Yeah, he has to eat out of vending machines. He can't even really cook for himself. Like, things are not that good. But also, like, combine this very foreign reality to me here in America with a very American soundtrack of like, you know, the Kinks and God, who else is on that soundtrack? I don't know. I should have wrote them down before we jumped in here. And you end up with a picture that feels uniquely wholesome and very universal, like regardless of where you're watching. Hirayama enjoys foreign music, and I'm watching a foreign film from the place where his music is coming from. Like, that gives you a connection like that feels very special. And I don't know how exactly Wenders landed on that, but man, it just feels so special. But before we wrap up, I do want to talk about, it is 2 hours long, and boy, like it when you're going on like your fifth or sixth day with Hirayama, you're like
going
okay,
to the toilet.
I know, yeah. They do get shorter. That's right, and things happen in them for sure. But the routine starts to feel very samey, and I think that's another part of the reason why people have walked away from this and been like, it's dull and sad, and Hirayama's life sucks, like because he does the same thing all the time. Your mileage may vary, I guess.
I mean, the thing I got from that is like, yes, his life is very routine, very dull. But I think that that's a parallel to how a lot of life is for a lot of people with regular jobs. Like, your job largely doesn't change all that much day to day. Like, your routines are largely the same. Just because his is cleaning toilets, it's not much different from, you know, doing the same thing in an office for day in and day out. The length is, it's a bit of a struggle. I definitely like the second half, the second hour more than the first hour. The first hour is largely his, you know, you have almost 20 to 30 minutes on his first day and then you kind of repeat it, but then it gets shorter, more efficient. And then we start to introduce more characters. You also have these dream sequences where he kind of dreams about what's happening, or things that have happened throughout the day. And the movie's also in 4:3, which is interesting. I think it could be a little bit shorter and get the same effect across. At the same time, it's one of those movies that's, it's a bit of a struggle to get through, but you'll be glad you did. Like, it's a homework film. It's eating your vegetables. It's because it's incredible to talk about once you've gotten to the end of it.
Yeah, one of these quote reviews in the trailer we're running for it on the live stream. If you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, thanks for watching. Is a feast of slow cinema. Right, a feast, and I think that's accurate. Like, it is slow, but in the best ways. Like, in the way that you want slow cinema to be, not so achingly slow that something like Memoria, you're like, oh my god, I'm watching a slideshow. Like, I also, you mentioned it's 4:3. I do wish it was widescreen. It's beautiful. It's a very well shot film. Like, it's a shame that you don't actually get those sides of the frame at all. It's just like a square, but I think it plays to like the lo-fi analog nature of Hirayama's
simplistic
life.
Nature of it. Yeah, for sure.
Right. And I see that. But also, man, like, widescreen would have been rad. Either way, I'm glad we watched Perfect Days. Like, it got a lot of buzz last year, and we had missed it, and I wasn't really sure if we were going to catch it. So, shout out to Hulu for hosting. Any other thoughts or recommendations?
No, I think I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend Perfect Days?
I would, with a few caveats. I think it is a great film. It's this kind of character study of someone with a very simple, routine, mundane life, but that has a lot of joy in those routines and in his day-to-day life. And you see that his life has also kind of been marked by tragedy and the falling outs of close relationships. And it's also about the need of human connection, no matter how happy you are in your day-to-day life. I think it's beautifully shot. The City of Tokyo's a character all of its own. It is long. It is slow. So just pace yourself and be patient. You'll be glad you did.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I think this movie is really good. I liked it a lot. I don't know if I loved it. But it's really special, and I'm glad I spent the time with it. So if you're interested, if you heard what we had to say and thought, man, I got to check out Perfect Days, do, please. It's on Hulu. You won't be disappointed. You can even watch it in chunks if you like. You can pace it out a little bit. But yeah, I think Hirayama's journey is really special, and I'm glad we checked it out. Even if it doesn't really check the boxes of larger things happening throughout, like there's something really cool there. Worth the time, worth the effort, worth the journey. And if I'm ever in Tokyo, oh my God, I'm hitting like six of these toilets, dude. I can't wait. It's gonna be like luxury. With that, we should wrap up the show. Shoot, episode 267 behind us already. I don't believe it. Andy, what are we watching next week?
We're going to be taking a look at The Substance. This is a highly anticipated thing we've been talking about for a while. This is Demi Moore's new film, which also stars Dennis Quaid and Margaret Qualley. Demi Moore is an aging Hollywood star, a little bit like she is in real life, who takes this black market drug to then become a younger version of herself, the younger version played by Margaret Qualley. Of course, this is kind of a deal with the devil that will have devastating consequences. This won the I think it was screenwriting prize at Cannes. Lots of buzz about this. This is directed by French director Coralie Fargeau, who previously did Revenge, a 2018 film. Heard lots of buzz about this movie. Can't wait. We're going to be seeing that this Friday. It is a little bit long. It is 2 hours, 20 minutes. Some FYI releases this week. Transformers 1, which is the animated Transformers film, that's going to be out this week. Take the kids, take the family. Wolfs, the kind of hitman mob movie with Brad Pitt and George Clooney, is also coming out this week. That's a straight to streaming on Apple TV joint. So that's a whole strange other thing. If you have Apple TV, you can check that out. Upcoming in the following weeks, Megalopolis and The Wild Robot. But for next week, The Substance, and we'll see what else we're looking at.
Let me tell you, I was really trying to nail down Megalopolis IMAX screenings for September 23rd. It's the one night only Riot event. No Cinemark near us has it. And we live in the town where Cinemark is headquartered. So I don't know if Cinemark just got totally left out of those. AMC's got them. And I think Regal might have them. But if you're looking to get a ticket, you better jump on it quick. Because by the time I found out AMC was the only one in town running it, like one screen here in town, we couldn't do it. We will go see Megalopolis, though. Stoked to see it. Very excited for Substance. I hate the runtime, but it looks so weird, dude. Body horror and big weird lenses and all kinds of freaky stuff. I hope it's
people
rad.
People throwing up in the aisles.
That's right, dude. I can't wait. Dennis Quaid playing a freak. Oh, it's going to be good. I hope. Boy, it's all I can hope for. Clearly, I'm not overhyped. But if you're excited about The Substance, are you looking forward to Megalopolis? Maybe have some suggestions for things we should watch that maybe you've seen, right? Let us know. Best way to let us know is to email us directly, mail@offscriptfilmview.com, or you can check out our website, of course, offscriptfilmview.com. Email your thinking, but it's 2024. I want a comment in a box, and you can. We put the show on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, we're on all the usual social media places. And of course, for our audio listeners, we're on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartMedia, Amazon Music, I think we're floating around over there, all the usual places. You can find us, Offscript, right there every week. Every Tuesday, except this week because it's Wednesday because I had something going on, admittedly. But next Tuesday, we'll be back with The Substance and more. And, God, I think that's it from all of us. Oh, and subscribe. Subscribe, of course, and like and comment and click the notification bell. All the usual stuff. Do a solid for you boys here at Offscript. We'd appreciate it. We appreciate you. And from all of us at Offscript, the home of Bold Cinema, I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.